doing to make those conversations happen. Mm. And that attention really focused on what we've seen is that a lot of groups of three tend to align into a hierarchical structure where there's a leader, someone who we're tentatively calling sort of the collaborator, who so the leader and collaborator talk to each other a lot. They do most, like, 80 to 90% of the talking in the group. So they're hashing things out. And there's some interesting dynamics with the leader and the collaborator that can come up. And then there's a third person who pretty distinctly does not talk as much. And at first, I wasn't paying a lot of attention to them because, go figure, transcript-based research privileges speech. Yeah. And it was actually Caitlin, this undergraduate who's been doing research with me, I feel like it's with me at this point. She's doing such wonderful work, who really was pushing on this idea of quiet students as something we should pay attention to, and started bringing in this other literature, some K-12 studies, looking at what quiet students, like why students are quiet, but also what they do within groups. And it turns out they can have these really powerful mediator roles. You know, the two, the leader and the collaborator are going at it. And by taking a step back and being out of it, theoretically, these students then can take more of a, well, I was going to say metacognitive, and I don't want to go into too much jargon, but right, they're a little more able to monitor their group and apply, I guess, different regulation to the group where, like, if two people are stuck, if the two talking people are just so deep in whatever they're in that they've gotten stuck or have a disagreement they can't resolve, quiet group members theoretically can be tiebreakers. Or if, you know, it's taking too long and we just need to move on, they can help pull the group forward in that way. Something also that's an interesting interaction is that for this kind of influence to happen, often there also needs to be some action by the leader who will do moves. So the technical term in qualitative research of, like, here's a thing you do that facilitates, and we call it a move, who would do moves that would open the floor for feedback or solicit feedback, which is different. So opening the floor for feedback would be like, I'm going to propose an idea, but when I propose the idea, the point is to get an idea out there so that the rest of the team can add to it.
Yeah.
But they can also specifically ask someone, like, what do you think? Or do you agree with this? Mm-hmm. And so there's this role of this leader person to extend influence.
Yeah.
And so there are two pieces of this research now that I'm working on. One is this what is happening? What is it that the quiet students are doing and quiet group members are doing? I need to be careful about that. Quiet students and quiet group members are not necessarily the same thing. Mm-hmm. Someone who is talkative could choose to be quiet in a group. That's a role you can take on. So one of the things we're trying to understand then is, like, what is this role where a quiet group member can still be engaged with a group and have influence on the group? What are the ways that they do this? It's not captured well in, again, like the traditional transcript-based analysis, because it seems like their moves to regulate the group are very efficient in terms of speech and sometimes are nonverbal. So so Caitlin's side of the project this year is to focus specifically on that quiet group member. We're recording videos of groups right now, not right now, but last week recorded, next week we're recording, we'll record again in a few weeks, where we want to see this in action again, but this time we're going to be interviewing the group members as well, because we want to understand what they think of the role that they're in, because there is also for quiet group members the potential for marginalization to be happening. There's a lot of reasons a person can choose to be quiet in a group, not all good, or perhaps they're not always choosing, they might be sidelined into it. So we want to understand a little more of that, and also the ways that the quiet group members perceive their participation in the group. And that doing the interviews will help with that. Meanwhile, I'm focusing a little more on this big group structure. And so the things like, how does the leader offer, how does a leader, person who is in a leadership position in the group, open the floor for feedback? And how does the collaborator take that up? And sort of this, you know, complex system of three to understand the whole group while Caitlin is focusing a little more on the quiet student actions and experience.
It's so interesting that the work is so relational, because you could put three people, or you can have nine people in a room, and if you like slot off three of them into three separate groups, the groups could be like completely different, and you mix them up.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Just to clarify, why is the study focused on triads?
Because that's how we had started our what we have hypothesized in the past is that with the lab activities that we have, and this isn't a lab context that we're studying, because what we've found is that the tasks support much better collaboration compared to like pen and paper problem solving. But what we have kind of hypothesized in the past is that three is sort of the sweet spot for having enough members of the group without having the group so large that it encourages social loafing.
Okay.
Which is the technical term for when somebody is not pulling their weight in a group.
Oh, okay.
And there's a whole psychological study thing of, like if you can't see what your contribution is to the group, then you're not going to work as hard.
Is this like, psychology or sociology, like a group problem?
Yeah.
Where it's like a clean air, for example, there's too many other people who could also be responsible.
Yeah.
But if it's like my house, I'm going to fix the door.
Yeah.
But if it's like clean air, like any other human on the planet could also do that.
I think that's similar. I think the starting study for this had to do with people and doing tug of war. And that people are like, the more people you had on the team, the less force any individual pulled with. This is like research
literally
from 100 years ago. So that's part of it. I think the other part that we've really focused on triads is that they do invite the structure of two people who talk a lot and one person who is taking a step back. If you have quadrads, if you have groups of four, then you have a tendency to pair off, to basically end up with two subgroups.
Yeah.
And of course, if you have dyads, if you have pairs, then they don't have like a third person. And so odd numbers, I think there's something special about that where there's no easy pairing off. And so they support this kind of structure of having that metacognitive, I've taken a step back kind of role.
Yeah, absolutely.
How frequently does this dynamic occur when you have a group of three students? Is it like always, or?
I don't know yet.
Okay,
we're working on that.
Okay.
We have analyzed the old videos we were looking at. We looked at something like 10, and it was pretty clear, I think, in the majority of them. I don't remember the exact number. in the majority of them, it was pretty clear that there was a student who was much less talkative than the other two. Sometimes it was a little unclear who was in the leadership position, and that often was correlated with the groups not being as efficient or well organized, and so a lot more cooperation instead of collaboration in the groups where there wasn't a clear leader. And so cooperation meaning we're going to parallelize our tasks, like you do this, you do this, we're not going to talk to each other, then we'll share our results at the end, you do your calculation, you do your calculation.
Yeah.
But, like, there's none of this shared aspect.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah. I've been in group like that before, too.
Yeah, sure.
It's definitely not as fun. That's so interesting. And I think part of this is just, like, me being not as familiar with social science.
Sure.
But it seems like triads working together to accomplish tasks is, like, more insight in that is applicable to so many things, like activism, just a group trying to solve any sort of problem.
Yeah.
So how does the discussion between those different like areas of study work in your field?
Not as much as I hope it would. So where I have been drawing from a lot is, like I mentioned before, sociology, and that gets into ideas of status and hierarchy. Also, group psychology or social psychology has been very salient for the work that I do, and education mm-hmm. has, go figure, people in education have been studying groups for years when people in physics education research are like, ooh, group work is so hot right now. I say that one of the frustrations that I have within my field is that, and it's gotten much better in the past several years, but because it is physicists who stepped into education, I think there's a bit of epistemic trespass that happens. Sort of this idea of like, we don't need to talk to experts in this. We can just figure it out ourselves.
I could see that happening.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there is sort of a culture within physics of like, we're smart. We can figure out all the things.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which can be pretty rough. yeah. And so, like, early PER for, like, which started in the early 90s. So it's a generally young subfield. Mm-hmm. I think that it didn't draw very much on education. Mm-hmm. It didn't. I know. I've read the papers. I've seen their citations. There's mm-hmm. a lot of self-citing within mm-hmm. the not necessarily citing yourself, but like yeah. citations within the community. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten better, but there still will be papers that I will read or review where I'll say, hey, you're only citing PhysRev PER, which is one of the specialized journals, but mm-hmm. there's a whole, you know, education yeah. has been group work, for example, like group work, this, you know, like this social psychology yeah. tug of war thing is 100 years old.
Yeah.
There are whole mm-hmm. handbooks on group work research mm-hmm. that are just like not coming up in things from that people from my community are citing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that I can help offer as part of the work that I'm doing these frameworks and these insights to bring in these ideas that are not just kind of what we see at the surface,
yeah.
but going a little deeper and building on the expertise and the work of those who've come before us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Even as you were kind of just setting up that study, I was like, I feel like I could take insights from this into like friendships, because I have a lot sure. of friendships of groups of three, and I was like mm-hmm. oh yes, chatty chatty quiet, that's how it
yeah
so, yeah yeah so yeah that's
and watch out, you're gonna be looking for who's the leader.
I know,
it can switch. There's one of the questions we have this semester is how fluid these roles are, because we think they might be task dependent. And so the videos we looked at before were very much like do the thing with the equipment and writing. But now in the labs, we have them do collaborative writing. And so I have one of the open questions, you know, you're talking about like, how do these things evolve? Like we have a thing we're looking for, we're focusing on, we have a framework that informs what data we focus on. But then there are these little questions of like, well, this is different in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe when they switch to writing, somebody else will take the wheel and be like, I am the person who's the strongest at writing. Let's yeah. go.
That makes yeah. sense.
Yeah.
That sort of reminds me of our dynamic in putting this podcast on together. Speaking of metacognition, because I feel like when we switch to equipment tasks, you are the leader because you're much better at that. But when it comes to like, let's email a million people. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Maddie, that's I will do that. Communication.
But like, isn't that also beautiful that when you work in a team, you can like have your preferences and your strengths and like gravitate towards those?
Yeah.
Totally.
Like yes.
what a wonderful thing to like be able to respect those and not just be like, well, everyone has to learn how to do the same thing and just like deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We just kind of like we're like yin and yang.
Yeah.
Like we just kind of balance each other out very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, fantastic.
Cool.
So kind of switching gears a little bit. So do you have any suggestions for how to make learning environments kind of generally more inclusive of neurodivergent folks?
Ooh, I like this question. This kind of gets into my teaching side of things. Well, I can start with the group work thing. We'll stay on topic.
Okay,
So group work, I think that – I know that. I think that. I actually went to a seminar series over the summer that was I don't remember the person who hosted it. I'm so bad at remembering names.
It's okay. But we put it in the show notes.
We should put it in the show notes. I'll look it up. I'll send it to you because perfect. I know she's doing these again. That she is she's with the university, and her background is as a speech therapist, but working with neurodivergent kids.
Oh, yeah.
And she did this whole series, this whole lunchtime seminar series about executive functioning, which is a very useful framework to think about neurodiversity. And one of the things that she talked about is that with there are, you know, these like seven different domains of executive functioning, including things like task initiation, I guess focus, flexibility. I don't remember all of them. probably working memory. and like within these, like everyone sort of has some things that they're stronger with and some things they're perhaps not as strong with. Mm-hmm. But for folks who perhaps are neurodivergent, they might have bigger struggles with certain executive functioning skills, and then the regulation that they need, regulation, has to come from the external supports as opposed to internal supports.
Okay, makes sense.
One of the things that that came up during this seminar series was about group work and how a really important thing for neurodivergent folks who are working in groups, the powerful thing they can do is to have a conversation about expectations and supports.
Oh, yeah.
And so this can be for autistic students, it can be for ADHD students, whatever flavor of neurospicy. This idea of let's make sure everyone agrees with we know what our expectations are of each other, and we also know maybe like what each other's strengths are, and maybe what they're, again, there's some psychological safety stuff in here.
Totally.
Like you have to feel safe enough to be like, also I have a hard time with this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Maybe we can support each other as a team. And again, this is something you can learn as you become safe with somebody. Again, with the two of you, when you can be like, I'm having a really rough week this week, can you pick up a little more slack?
Yes. Yes. We have had those chats.
Yeah. Right. Like these are things that also benefit neurotypical people. And so something we've started doing in the introductory labs is doing team agreements where we have them have these conversations about expectations. And team agreements are not a brand new thing. Like team contracts, like they can go a lot of different ways, but we really focus on establishing expectations, but then also having a conversation with the team about what kind of support they can give each other. I don't use the word in the document, but like what kind of grace they can extend to each other, right? Based on things that can come up. And so I think that that can be one thing that can be helpful. And then to follow up with it, it's, you don't know actually how you're going to work with people till you've done it.
Yeah.
And so we have them follow up in like week five or so and ask them to try some new, check in about like, are the conversations fair? Is the division of labor equitable? So that's a thing that can happen at a group teamwork level. In terms of a large class, so I teach Physics 101, which is a class of about 400 students, and it is an executive functioning nightmare because it has so many pieces. There's lecture, there's discussion, there's lab, there's each lecture has homework stuff that's due the morning before lecture. Yeah. The lab has an assignment due the morning of lab. There's homework due on Thursdays. It's like if you lined it up just wrong, you would have something due in the class every single day of the week. It's rough. Yeah. And so there are things that I really try to do a lot of universal design for learning approaches with the idea that, like, if I do something that benefits, like, our DRES students, if it's already built into the course structure, it will benefit someone else in a way I can't even imagine. And so, like, some of the things I do is there are the homework deadlines I set up, and there is a homework deadline. Unfortunately, as people are being pragmatic about their time considerations, if there is no deadline, they will not do it, even though deadlines already introduce equity problems. But then I set up a second deadline that's 90% till they have a test on the material. And then I just leave the homework open for 70% for the rest of the semester. The idea being that if for whatever reason you mess up the deadline, you're fine.
Yeah.
10% off of a single homework assignment is not going to make or break your grade, but it's enough for you to be like, oh, I should probably do that on time.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's a weird support of a weird thing because I read Joe Feldman's, I think it was Teaching for Equity, and what he asserts is that just deadlines are bad. Like, roll the deadlines. Like, there are so many different reasons that a person could miss a deadline.
Yeah.
Neurodivergence, but also like stuff going on in their lives. And I was like, I love the idea, but I don't think that's going to work for the population that I work with. Also, he wrote this in a K-12 context, and so there are certain, you know, things like the students have to come to class. Like, they're like, they get in trouble if they're wandering around or not at school eventually. But yeah, so that made me really think about things like the deadlines, so that for whatever reason, people can still have that open to them in a predictable way. So that's also hitting on some of the neurodivergence, is that it's predictable.
Yeah.
But also then if something happens, there's still that motivation and like that like time crunch that supports task initiation. So that's a big thing. There are other things I do in my class that are not like targeted at neurodivergence, but can help. Like, I use auto captioning when I lecture. And I mean, a lot of the ADHD community is like, yes, captions. So like that can help also with like attention to have that visual cue. I'm trying to think of other stuff, and yeah, I do try to build it in, and certainly I'm more sensitive to sort of the needs of the ADHD community. It's something that I'm working on, is to be a little more mindful of what the autistic students would need. Certainly predictability, I know, and clear expectations. So, like, I don't change the schedule suddenly.
Yeah, I guess
some people do.
Those are all great. I love the agreements and, like, kind of, doing the metacognition of, like, talking about your – I feel like that's so healthy. And I feel like that's something that's, like – I don't know, at least in the mental health community, has more so been catching fire the past, like, 5-10 years. And I feel like that's so healthy, doing it, like – from early career and academic standpoint.
I mean, even in personal life, honestly, like, relationships are relationships.
Yes, absolutely.
There are lots of differences, but, like, even, it's so silly, there's a lot of stuff I learned within parenting about, like, setting boundaries, that then I'm like, oh, yeah, I can also set boundaries when I teach.
I was only
37 years old, 38 now, when I learned that, like, I'm not talking about this as a reasonable, like, I'm done talking about this as a reasonable boundary to set.
Yeah.
What?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so.
And again, not as a I'm being unreasonable, but like, the boundary has been set. We're not negotiating. I'm done talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much that kind of goes back and forth between the personal, professional, just, because a relationship is a relationship. So, on the topic of relationships, this one's at kind of a bigger scale, but as sort of we've talked about, part of your dissertation work was improving the introductory labs at Illinois. And so as a result of these, you've been studying culture changes, so sort of how, like, the students, CAs, and faculty interact. What have you learned about culture change in academia from that experience?
Not as much as I hoped. in the sense of balancing a research program with the teaching load that I have is challenging. It's good, but it's very challenging because most of my load, my work is teaching, and so it doesn't scale linearly. Like, you know, I have like a half as much expectation as like a mainstream faculty, but it's not really half. Culture change within the research context. I think so far I've really, most of my focus has been on the student experience and kind of what they have learned about themselves. And certainly something that has been really encouraging has been to see that they learn how to take on challenges and they notice that they're getting better at it, which is so cool. The teaching community culture, I haven't done research on. There is some research I was doing, some preliminary work, kind of looking at the different ways that instructors position themselves, in the sense of, I believe I'm helping you. What are the different styles of helping? There are sort of these archetypes that I've seen. One I call the lawnmower TA, which is just like a lawnmower parent. I'm going to mow down every problem you could ever. I think the most helpful thing for you is to never encounter a problem so you can smoothly get to the end.
Which is a great novice move. A couple times,
And not, I mean, it's like, as a person who has been teaching for more than 10 years now, I'm like, yeah, no, that's not good for them because they don't learn how to do hard things. Mm-hmm. But as a novice, I think that's a natural reaction to say, mm-hmm. I don't want my students to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. But it also doesn't give them a chance to do it. It doesn't, yeah. like, give them any agency over what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And what I've seen when I've observed classes where the TA kind of fits into this archetype is the second the students encounter anything, even later in the semester, they ask for help. Immediately. They're yeah. stuck until they can get help.
Yeah.
I've seen others that are sort of the, like, explainers, right? The, if I explain it to them clearly, then they'll get it. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I'm just going to fix it for you, but I'm going to spend a lot of time telling you things.
Oh,
and again, okay. like, it is a well-meant, approach, mm-hmm. but it's not very effective.
Yeah.
And once again, it sort of turns into, oh, we can't figure things out. We need to turn to this person as the source of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that are more interesting is TAs who take on roles that are more of, I'm going to ask you to explain your reasoning, mm-hmm. which is much more powerful. And then mm-hmm. one of the things that which much more powerful, it encourages this sort of overcoming and thinking for yourself mm-hmm. and that whole aspect. And then one of the things that can happen in the labs that's a little bit rare but super cool when it happens is that when, like, an experiment has an unexpected result and nobody really knows why, there's this fun little transition of the instructor into a temporary group member.
Oh,
and I have not looked at this one a lot, but, like, the fact that it exists is so cool.
Yeah.
But, like, these are these different, like, levels of, like, respecting student ideas, but also prompting them to share their ideas and generate their ideas. And I think this is not all lab specific. I mean, certainly the temporary group member, I think, is a lab specific kind of thing. But these other three can be really, like, they can happen in office hours. They can happen in, so office hours context would be, is a lot of homework help. It's a lot of students who are like, I am here with this question. Help me solve it. Which mm-hmm. is like, great. Yes. And I've been through that evolution too, right? Where it was like, I don't want my students uncomfortable. Like, let's warn them about all the problems beforehand.
Yes,
or, you know, I went through a very, I'm going to call it cringy stage of, like, trying to elicit student thinking by saying, well, what do you think? Oh, no. Again,
no.
novices mean well, but they're novices.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not mad at me, but I'm a little like, yeah, I've definitely learned how to to do this better now. So there's that piece, which is this, like, in the classroom culture, mm-hmm. and it's very influential, right? It influences the students a lot, because if they have some expectation of when they're going to get help, they'll, you know, if they always get help and don't think, they won't get better.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they do get better in the classroom. That is actually a really robust, informal observation, is that in these contexts where we repeatedly ask students to figure things out in a supported way, like, again, not like, here's some random equipment, good luck, but in a well-constrained way, we ask them to figure things out and justify their reasoning. Mm-hmm. What we find is that, again, this is informal, it's hard to measure formally, mm-hmm. is that they start out with a lot of very straightforward, like, how do I do this? What do you want this to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are the expectations? Everything's the same conversation. Regulation and expectations. And then they sort of transition to, we're stuck, what do we do? And then they transition to, we're stuck and we have this idea, do you think it's good? And then they can move on to, we're stuck and we tried this and it didn't work. Now can we have some help? Which to me is like a really cool evolution.
Yeah.
It's very robust in our labs that around week 4, 5, maybe 6, they start to make this transition from to actually, like, solving problems for themselves.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And it's only when they, like, get to the end of whatever they're trying
that
they're like, oh, yeah, actually, we need you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So that's, like, part of it. I'm like, I did some levels of how this works.
Yeah.
It's really fast. I feel like I work mostly as a research assistant in an experimental lab, and I feel like I see that all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really fascinating.
You get longer with them, though, which is just so wonderful. Because, like, the weird thing about teaching is we, like, start up these communities, and they only exist for 16 weeks. Yeah. And then we hit reset and start over again. And, like, especially from, like, December to January, it feels like from, like, May to August, like, everyone comes in August with all this energy, and it's like, all right, let's go. It's been a minute.